The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Hi, this is Dean Sullivan and you're listening to Dino's Download. Yes, it's our very own podcast. We're here on City Talk 105.9, Monday to Friday between the hours of 1 and 4 o'clock. That's when you can catch us. We cover everything from entertainment to the news to the arts, the paper reviews, the lot. Enough of me rambling on now. Let's take a listen to the best of what we had on the show this week.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Because of the large migration, they started a new program when they tried to help the Polish migrants coming back to Poland to readjust, because there could be some difficulties, especially with Polish bureaucracy. So we received as well like a kind of booklet that will help Polish people to readjust back to Poland. We brought it to Liverpool and we were giving it out for people on one of the Merseyside Polonia meetings in December. And to be honest, most of people were saying, no, we don't want to go back to Poland. We want to stay in Liverpool. We like it here.
We're hearing about all these Polish immigrants are going back to Poland and the drain on our own skilled workers. Are we going to find ourselves in a situation where we're not going to have the people to do our own jobs, assuming that we've got any jobs left?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if we focus on the Polish nationals for a second, I mean, I'll give you a couple of figures here. In 2007, we had 13,000 Polish nationals contact us in relation to visas or visa assistance. What we found that in 2008, especially in the latter part of 2008, that 13,000 inquiries jumped up to 24,000. Mm. And a lot of those people were interested in actually, you know, migrating to countries like I mentioned previously, Canada, Australia. And what we find in, you know, after having spoken to a lot of these individuals is that they were, you know, looking to use the English and the experience that they've gained here in the UK to move on to other countries where the economy is obviously perceived to be a little bit stronger and where they can obviously utilize their skills. So, you know, I think a lot of Polish nationals will be looking to return home, most definitely. But, you know, there is a fairly large percentage of those same Polish nationals who, you know, would consider a move further afield.
Talking to John Wheat, Michael Shields solicitor, about this latest development in the case. Do you really need this person's evidence to strengthen your case, John? Isn't the case strong enough as it stands?
We don't believe, frankly, that the final piece in the jigsaw. We think the jigsaw is complete anyway, Dean. Mm-hmm. As you know from the times I've spoken previously about Michael's case, the concern and the worry always is that it's bona fide information. Whatever this man's position is, it's bona fide information that's come from people of good character who've not been looking for this information, who have no connection with the Shields family, and it adds weight to the general feeling and everything else that we've submitted in this case, to the knowledge that Michael Shields is innocent. And you know, on its own, perhaps it isn't significant. Mm. Maybe it is someone who is just bragging and being the big I am to a number of British tourists who were on holiday. But it gives a general impression of what was happening in Bulgaria at this time.
That is the utter ridiculousness of this. Libraries across Wirral, including Penzi, are extremely well used. They haven't actually done a proper service review actually of library usage. This whole thing has been come from the strategic planning review, which actually did not visit inside of libraries.
They don't know what's going on inside these places?
They have absolutely no idea. No one visited Penzi Library at all. No one spoke to any member of staff at Penzi Library, any user group at all. And then on the form, they went and put things which are just not true.
Well, Claire, if you were able to, you know, to address the councillors yourself in person, what would you actually say to them, briefly?
Well, I did address them at the forum. I told them that this was completely ill-conceived, that they had no idea what the people of Wirral wanted.
Why has there not been an international outcry? As you so rightly said, if this was happening in another part of the world, people just wouldn't put up with it.
Well, I think that that people have accepted, or governments have accepted, that Israel has the right to behave like this in the region, because that isn't the view of most people. If you look at the protests in this country, we've had extremely large protests, both nationally and locally, going on against what's happening in Gaza. I would guess that the majority of people in this country are opposed to what is happening there, but unfortunately our government doesn't speak in their name. It backs George Bush. George Bush is doing this as his last act before he leaves office next week. And of course the Israelis have done it at this time in order to tie Barack Obama's hands when he becomes president. The Israelis' heightened attack on Gaza is at least in part because they fear there may be a ceasefire and they want to do as much damage as possible before it. So it's a very serious situation, and I hope that we can put enough pressure on the British government to make sure they do these things.
James, if you're actually saying that this is the normal way for people such as the Prince and his fellow officers to speak, you know, there'd be a lot of people out there who'd be very, very upset, who'd actually accuse him of being racist.
No, well, I don't think he is racist, funnily enough. His father, Prince Charles, is an enormous supporter, not only the Muslim society, but also the Jewish one. He believes in these ethnic majorities, or minorities, should I say. He has already declared, this is Prince Charles, that when he becomes king, he doesn't want to be defender of the faith, that's the Anglican faith, but of the faiths, all of them, including Buddhism and all that sort of thing. I honestly don't think he's racist. I think he's thick. I think he's stupid. I think he needs to grow up and be more aware of what he is saying. But I don't think he's being viciously racist. I really don't.
It was the last official event that we had. And, you know, it's been an amazing year. And what was fantastic is knowing all that, you know, we, the city, has been through over the last 5 years getting ready for it. It's typical for any big event, you know, to have trials and tribulations, but the whole year was just spectacular, and I really felt proud for the city and the people of the city.
How do you think in the long term the year will be seen now?
Well, I think that it's already starting. We're already starting to get a sense of that. I mean, you know, we've done some of the early economic figures and see that we've got economic return of about £800 million just for 2008 alone. You've got the European Commission President Barroso saying that it was the best ever capital of culture. You've got the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Andy Burnham, saying that he'd like to create a British capital of culture using Liverpool as the model. And, you know, that's really where it starts. I think that, similar to Glasgow, which is still feeling the benefits of its capital of culture year in 1990, you know, that's what we're gonna feel in 2 decades from now. And I think the fact that we're seeing so much positive benefit already is just spectacular. The fact that our tourism numbers are really through the roof, I just think that there's a lot of great things to come.
Sadly, we're gathering signatures that we're going to take down once they're all done to the Ministry of Justice, to the Lord Chief of England and Wales. We're sending a message out that the judges of this country are not following the guidelines that have been set out by the government. As a family who's lost 2 children through acts of homicide, I thought life meant life, and then 2 minutes later, the judge says, with a tariff, in my daughter's case of 21 years, that's just not good enough for taking a life. And first-degree murder, he should give up the right to a life of his own.
You know, the global recession is biting deep, and at this time of the year, people are going to feel it more so than normal.
And what do you think we can expect on the high streets in the next 6 months, say, for example?
I think Liverpool is in a far more buoyant position than most been. You know, on the back of Liverpool 08, we've got Liverpool 1, and we've got the arena, but also the 15 million people who came into Liverpool as a result of the European capital of culture. You know, all the economic impact studies are telling us that 25% of those had never come to Liverpool. So if we get but a small percentage of those back, Dean, we'll have done a really good job. I think it is something that, you know, the whole country is going to suffer from. You know, as individuals, we're all having to tighten our belts, and I think people are going to have to be a lot more creative.
Why can't we get into the habit as a nation of, you know, taking our litter home with us or putting it in a bin?
The problem that we have is that the majority of people do that. They have bins, they see them, they use them. There is a small minority of people who are creating a lot of litter, and we just simply can't understand why it's so difficult to use a bin.
Have we got enough bins, basically? Is that where the problem lies?
Yeah, I mean, the bins are there. I mean, this is often an excuse that's levelled, you know, that there are no bins. At the end of the day, if it's your litter, you need to find somewhere to put it. I mean, one of the things that we're speaking to the chief executives of these outlets about is about placement of bins. Now, often, for example, you will find bins outside, say, McDonald's. But what we know from our research is that people don't eat outside McDonald's. They'll walk 500 yards down the street and then throw their rubbish. So what we want to do is advise them on where to put these bins, perhaps sponsor bins, or just that short way away where we know people are throwing their litter.
Can you believe it? We've been doing Most Wanted Live now for 8 years. To be honest, I would have honestly thought, you know, it would have finished quite a few years ago, you know. But the viewing figures just keep rising and going up, and I think, you know, many different people start to take an interest in the show, and the audience is growing, not just here in England but also across the pond, like in America. We do shows over there, and it's become a little bit of a cult show. In America, they did a satire of us on Saturday Night Live, and so it's becoming quite a sort of world-known show. It's, you know, shown in New Zealand and Australia and all the European places, and so it's doing really, really well from a little show that was thought up in myself and my husband's dining room 8 years, nine years ago.
Oh, was it originally your idea?
Yeah.
Wow, great.
Yeah, so we just sort of, we didn't have much money at the time, and we just came up with this idea, threw all the money that we had into this idea, made our own pilot programme and tried to sell it to, you know, anybody. We went to every single TV channel and they all said, no, ghost programmes don't work. And it was, you know, purely, it's not what you know, it's who you know. It was somebody that we knew at Living TV at the time. And they saw it and said, yeah, we'll have that. And we thought, my God, you know, it's just amazing that it had happened. And, you know, thank God we'd invested our money into it, because otherwise, well, I don't know, we'd probably be living in a cardboard box now.
The Sullivan Show with Dean Sullivan.
Joining me now is Yvette Fielding, the presenter of Most Haunted on the Living Channel. Yvette, you're down at St George's Hall. What's going on down there?
Lots of strange stuff, I have to say. Lots of spooky things. We've been doing, we are in the middle of doing a seven-night investigation around the northwest, and the studio is based in St George's Hall. It's supposed to be haunted, and so far, on the night that we've been doing a Ouija board in the centre of the hall, we've had a lot of activity. An audience of about 500, 600 people have actually started seeing things, dark shadows, and we've had whistling noises and strange, odd groaning noises. And so it's been really, really exciting and really different, and the audience are really enjoying it.
Well, St George's Hall certainly has a checkered history. Of course, it used to be the site of the law courts down there, so many a famous trial has taken place, and many a colourful character has been held in the cells there down below as well.
I can imagine. On the last night, we're going to be investigating the courts, as you say, and there's a sort of underground tunnelling system. Mm. So we're going to be down there, and some of the staff refuse to go down there. They don't like it, and they sense and see, you know, dark shadows and horrible presence. So whether any of these are connected to, like you say, some of these characters that have been tried there, who knows?
Well, certainly, I'm sure the walls of St George's Hall are steeped, you know, with the psyches of all these people.
Yeah.
And now tell us about Most Haunted. It's a big show, isn't it? Massive show.
Yeah, can you believe it? We've been doing Most Haunted Live now for 8 years.
Wow.
To be honest, I would have honestly thought, you know, it would have finished quite a few years ago, you know. But the viewing figures just keep rising and going up. And I think, you know, many different people start to take an interest in the show, and the audience is growing, not just here in England but also across the pond, like in America. We do shows over there, and it's become a little bit of a cult show. In America, they did a satire of us on Saturday Night Live, and so it's becoming quite a sort of world-known show. It's, you know, shown in New Zealand and Australia and all the European places. And so it's doing really, really well from a little show that was thought up in myself and my husband's dining room 8 years, nine years ago.
Oh, was it originally your idea?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, great.
Yeah, so we just sort of, we didn't have much money at the time, and we just came up with this idea, threw all the money that we had into this idea, made our own pilot program and tried to sell it to, you know, anybody. We went to every single TV channel and they all said, no, ghost programs don't work. And it was, you know, purely, it's not what you know, it's who you know. It was somebody that we knew at Living TV at the time. And they saw it and said, yeah, we'll have that. And we thought, my God, you know, it's just amazing that it had happened. And you know, thank God we'd invested our money into it, because otherwise, well, I don't know, we'd probably be living in a cardboard box now.
Well, Yvette, you certainly proved them all wrong then, haven't you? Why do you think people are so fascinated with the paranormal?
I don't know. It's very strange, isn't it? I believe in trends, and, you know, the paranormal was very, very, very popular after the First World War. You know, many people had lost loved ones, and so they went to mediums and they joined spiritualist churches and so on, just to, you know, have hope that their loved ones were, you know, still around, still sort of looking over them. And I don't know, just of late, in the last sort of 10 years, people seem to have sort of, the trend has come back again. And I think it's got a lot to do with all the unrest that's going on at the moment in the world after 9/11 and, you know, family members going off to fight in the Middle East and so on. And I think people just want hope. They want reassurance that there is something there.
And was it something you were interested in before you came up with the idea?
No, not. I was always interested in the paranormal, but only as much as, you know, when a group of girls get together on a Friday night with a bottle of wine and, you know, you invite a medium round to your house and you all chip in and pay a fiver or whatever. And I remember doing that quite a few times. And then I got into reading a lot of books about, you know, what happens when you die. And I was very interested in the medium James Van Praagh and John Edwards. And I read some of their books, and I got into it slowly that way. And then that was it. And it was just a friend that came over and said that, you know, he'd spent his last weekend on holiday at a place called Michelin Priory down south in Essex. And you know, that, and it, as he was leaving that day, he said, oh, by the way, it's got 13 ghosts, how spooky, you know, and that's how the idea came about.
Now, over the years, of course, there have been many, many sceptics. Famously, I'm thinking of Harry Houdini, who wanted to expose these charlatans, as a lot of people taking advantage of. What's your reaction to anyone who says, oh, it's a load of rubbish, it's just all in people's imaginations?
Well, there's two types. There is, like, people, you know, Harry Houdini did a fantastic thing, you know, he wanted to sort of whittle out the fakes and the frauds, and there were so many in his time, and the spiritualism era, you know, the mediums were the so many of them, and there are many fraudulent mediums out there today, and it upsets me when there are lots of people that give money for readings and they're just being swindled, you know. That's one side of it I don't like, but the other side of it, which is where my good friend Dr. Kieran O'Keefe sits, is to be sceptical, and that's a healthy thing. You know, it's good to go into an investigation and be sceptical, because you're open to it, you're open to both sides. You don't just, if there's a cold breeze blowing on your face, you don't just go, oh my God, it's a ghost. You actually think, well, actually, there could be a window open or a vent open somewhere. Is there air conditioning on, and so on. So it's actually really healthy to be sceptical when you go into an investigation. But the best bit I love is actually trying to turn that sceptic into a believer and actually say, do you know what, I can't explain that. That is really interesting, and it could be paranormal.
I'm talking to Yvette Fielding, presenter of Most Haunted on the Living Channel, who's at St George's Hall all this week in Liverpool. And I know, Yvette, we'll be talking to you again later in the week as well. Have you had any personal experience yourself personally where, you know, someone you've known who's passed over has actually, you know, come back with a message for you or an experience for you?
Well, my dad died in July last year, which was a big shock because he was quite young. It was very strange. I really felt that he was around, there was, we get what's called, you know, tappings or rappings that you can hear on Most Haunted, and they're just like knockings on the wall or underneath your feet. You can't actually really tell where the noises are coming from, but we had lots and lots of tappings and rappings after my father died in the house, and you know, I would say two for yes, one for no, and Kieran would get me to ask lots of controlled questions, and it turned out through the tappings that you know.
What do you mean by controlled questions that, like, only your dad would know the answers to?
Yeah, exactly. So we did some controlled questions and discovered that I believe that it was my father. And also the smell of his aftershave, you know, you'd be walking down the stairs and it would be so strong. my husband Carl bought me a diamond ring when my dad died, and he said, you know, this ring is from your father to tell you he loved you. And he, you know, Carl said, oh, he was with me when we bought this ring. And I lost it, and I was very upset and crying, and I was just saying to Carl, I can't find this ring. Dad, can you help me find the ring? I need you to find it. Turn around, and it was on the floor by my feet, and I'd been looking for it everywhere, but it was by my feet. It was just bizarre. And lots of different things, you know, that just really odd things that only my dad would do and say. And so I used to, when people used to interview me about Most Haunted, I would say, oh, I'm skeptical, I sit on the fence. Now I know that there is life after death, and I know that my dad, you know, hasn't died. His body's dead, but he's still alive, as is my grandmother. And I truly, truly believe, and it's made me deal with my father's death. I was able to cope with it a lot more. And actually, I know this sounds absolutely barking mad, but, you know, I chat away to my dad, you know, when I'm on my own. People have probably put me away in a mental home, but it makes me feel a lot happier.
It's a source
knowing
of comfort.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is a comfort. Mm. And I think it's really important, you know, that, and that's what I want to try and do on Most Haunted, you know, is sort of, people that have lost loved ones, is almost like, do you know, there is hope, you know, that when they're gone, they're not gone, that they're still here. And I think that's really important, because it helped me cope with my dad passing.
Yvette, great talking to you. We'll be catching up with you later in the week.
All right, Dean, take care.
You too.
You soon. Bye, love.
He is the biggest black recording star Britain has ever produced, one who has sold over 30 million records in his lifetime. He's collected a pile of gold and platinum records across the world and hit the number one spot worldwide on pop charts, including the USA, Australia, Germany, Holland and the UK. He has achieved extraordinary success as both an artist and a songwriter, and he joins me in the City Cafe now. Of course, I'm talking about the legend that is Mr. Billy Ocean.
How are you doing, Kevin?
How are you?
I'm fine, man. Yourself?
I'm very well indeed. It's Dean here, Dean Sullivan.
It's Dean, I'm sorry, yeah, I'm
City
sorry.
Talk 105.9. No problem. Kelvin was just picking you up there, calling
okay,
you earlier
okay,
on.
Okay.
How are you anyway? You're on tour at the moment. How's it going?
Next week. I start on my birthday.
Wow, great.
And 21st of January.
You kick off in St. Albans. And of course, you're coming up to this part of the world a couple of days later on the 25th to New Brighton.
Right, and I've got 41 days throughout the United Kingdom.
Excellent.
Which I'm looking forward to very much.
It's great. Have you played in this part of the world before? I'm sure you have, Billy.
I'm sure I have.
Yeah?
I mean, even, maybe not this time around, but, you know, in the times past.
And how about up in Liverpool? Have you played up here before?
No, I'm going to Liverpool on this tour.
Yeah.
I think I was in Liverpool, you know, time past during the Caribbean Queen.
Excellent. Well, it's a tour that you've been putting together for some time, because you had a little bit of a rest for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a little bit of necessary rest, really, because, you know, you might be Billy Ocean, but you're a dad.
Yeah.
You're responsible, you're a father, and I just felt at that time I'm doing what I'm doing and sort of drifting further and further away from my family, and I just felt, you know, I needed to be there for certain things.
Okay, so
I decided to take a little time off, but it sort of drifted off into 15 years. I mean, it's one of these things you don't plan it. It's just a necessary thing that you're aware of as a responsible person and realize that you have to contribute.
And what was it that brought you back into the game then?
Well,
the kids had grown up, was that what it was?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, you sort of one day you wake up, very much the same way that you make the decision. You sort of wake up one day and I looked around and everybody's grown up, everybody's driving, everybody's independent. And here I am just sort of, you know, getting closer to, you know, getting my bus pass. So I thought, you know, let me do something about it.
Excellent. So,
and here I am back on the road again.
And kicking off the tour, as you said, next week on your birthday.
That's right, on my birthday. I won't tell you how old I am. I'm 59. I'll be 59.
Excellent. Well, it's a long career. Take us right back to the beginning then, Billy. Where were you born? In Trinidad, I believe.
Trinidad, yeah.
And then what brought you over to the London's East End?
Well, my parents, my dad came to England just before the Windrush period. And my mum came during the Windrush period. My father thought it best for us to travel to give the kids an opportunity.
What do you mean by the Windrush?
You know, the Windrush is
explain.
When The Windrush, you know, okay, I tell you what Windrush is. Windrush is when the British government was applied to the West Indies for workers to come, you know, to do, you know, domestics, hospitals, you know, menial tasks.
Transport.
Yeah, transport. There you go, there you go. I forgot that, transport. In fact, my father worked for the Underground.
Right.
And, you know, they were very proud of their jobs, you know. They were very, you know, they were very disciplined about it. They were proud of their uniform. They
couldn't have survived without them because, you know, that's why the cry went out for help, really.
That's right, that's right. Mm. You know, we were glad to contribute. I mean, you know, there were benefits from it. Our parents, most of our parents never benefited. It was, the generations that came after, like myself, and we, you know, we made use of it. When my parents, I never forget when my dad said, we're coming to England for better, what is it, better, a better way of life, better education, and let's go and make a go of it. And I've always had that attitude that I'm still driven by those words, if you know what I'm saying.
I'm talking to my special guest in the cafe, Billy Ocean. So who were the early influences on you then, musically, would you say, Billy?
Musically?
Who did you like to listen to, dance to?
Oh, Christ, in them days, you had Otis Redding, you had James Brown, you had Marvin Gaye, you know, the dance music sort of became... But then dance music was always around. You know, dance music, whether you want to call it, you know, from Chubby Checker time, Twist Again, whatever. But, you know, great American music was coming over. But
and were they great role models for you?
They were role models.
The likes of Otis Redding, I'm thinking of Sam Cooke,
yeah,
those sort of people.
I mean, you know, they were role models. I had role models coming over from America. I had role models in this country as well. That was a great time of music for England. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, a lot of original creative music. So I came out of a period where there was an abundance of good music.
So music was always a part of your life then?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what made you decide, what was it that gave you the impetus to make it into a career? How did that come about?
That's an interesting... Because my father is a musician, we were all... Because of the way it was, there was... You know, you come from the third world. You come from Trinidad. There was no television, there was no radio. Right? Eventually, okay, my dad did get a radio, bought a radio, but, you know, prior to that, entertainment was self-entertainment, where we would sort of, you know, like maybe on a Friday night or Saturday, we would sort of put on little mini concerts between ourselves, or with the church, or with the community.
Right.
And you learned.
Was the church a big influence as well in your life?
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. The church was really the backbone of the community, really. There was also the different, there were Catholics, there was... But I was fortunate that I used to go to different churches. My mother was Church of England, my father was a Baptist. The people that my parents left us with when they came to England, they were Catholics, you know...
A real mixed bag there.
Yeah, a real mixed bag, which at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because if you're worshipping the same God...
Well, exactly.
That's the madness of it, you know?
We're all singing from the same hymn sheet.
Exactly, it's a madness. But nonetheless, the experiences are very good. You know, the fact that, you know, my mother used to, when we were in Trinidad, she was a domestic. So I was introduced to different nationalities at a very early age. My mother used to work for... in them days, we call them the white people, right? You know, excuse my phrase, but this is how we, you know, maybe they call us the black people, I don't know.
Well, that's the way it was. That's the way it was in those days,
exactly,
wasn't it?
That's the way it was.
We can't deny that.
Thank you very much. And these, what they had their own sort of community, and you find that most of them were involved in the oil fields, right? And my mother and, you know, and people from the local community, some of them were like, you know, domestics. My mother worked for Indians. My mother worked for, as I say, the white people. My mother worked for Chinese people, right? So I was introduced to all these different people. It's almost like sometimes I think, when I look back at my life and what I'm doing, I think, wow, you know, sometimes we're going through life, but something or somebody's taken us through a path that one day will be useful to us.
Absolutely,
you
yes.
Know?
That's
it's
a,
amazing how these things work.
Very philosophical way of looking at things.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So you know, by the time I came to England, as I said, mixing with the white kids was a strange thing because we never really mixed as such. So when I came to England and I'm going to school with all these white kids, it was like, wow, what do I do here?
Mm.
How do I? But you know, you soon get.
But you were able to cope with that then.
Pardon?
You were able to cope because you had to cope.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you
just got on with it.
You got on with it. It's like advent into success in the music business. Mm. I bought a piano. I'm self-taught. You know, I play the drums, guitar, I'm doing different instruments, enough to write songs and thing on. But it's like when Love Really Hurts started moving up the chart.
That was your first big hit, wasn't it?
And I was thrown in literally at the deep end. Suddenly, from nowhere, I'm doing Top of the Pops in front of 13 million people.
And what was that experience like?
Oh, my God, I'll tell you about it, man. Oh.
You are literally thrown in at the deep end, aren't
literally
you?
Literally thrown in the deep end. I'll never forget the nervousness. I'll never forget that, but what an experience.
Now, Love Really Hurts Without You. I'm talking, by the way, if you're just tuning in to my special guest in the cafe, Billy Ocean, about to embark on a nationwide tour coming to the Floral Pavilion in New Brighton up here in Liverpool. Love Really Hurts Then, Without You, the big one. What was that? Is that self-penned?
Yeah.
And so... Like based on reality?
Pardon?
Based on reality? Someone dumped you?
Yeah. In fact, it was a little bit like that. It was intentional to the... I didn't totally know what I was doing. I'll explain this to you, right?
Mm.
I'm sitting at the piano, right? And I started messing around with these chords, and suddenly this riff came, doom, 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 doom. Melody came, lyrics came. But around the same time, I had a falling out with my girlfriend, who is now my wife.
Oh, well, it ended happily then. That's the main thing.
Yeah,
the story ended happily.
So I wouldn't say it was intentional, but it's like some songs come along. They just come.
Yeah.
And this came along with words and melody. I mean, you know, three quarters of the song was finished. I did finish it off with the then producer who I was working with. But it came.
And also another huge...
Not crossing you, but you see, a lot of the song that I write is really based on life's experience, not necessarily mine.
Yeah.
But you have so many experiences to base around.
Well, I was going to talk about another huge hit of yours, When the Going Gets Tough, of course, a soundtrack, theme song.
That's right.
For the Jewel of the Nile. Just quickly, Billy, how did that come about?
I was asked to write the song for the track.
Yeah.
And the joy of the whole thing after writing the song and it being accepted, I did that with a producer called Matt Lang, and after writing the song and it being accepted, it was like the cream and the it was like icing on the cake when, you know, to find out that Danny DeVito, Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner was going to appear in the video.
Brilliant. Now, will your fans be expecting to hear these songs on the tour?
Of course. The show is made up of...
Excellent.
The show is... well, then, if I'm not doing that, then what am I doing?
Then exactly. What they want.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's a bit egotistical to think that, oh, forget all the old songs, I'm going to do new songs. Well, you could have a dead show.
Of course. I'm talking to my special guest, Billy Ocean, ahead of his gig in New Brighton on the 25th of January. Billy, it's always been a pleasure talking to you. We're going to play out with your new single, Because I Love You.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. God bless. Will I see you at the show?
You will, yes, of course.
Please come and say
I will
hello.
Do.
Take care, man.
Nice talking
God
to you,
bless.
Billy.
Bye, bye.
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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're in my head, you're in my head. I'm living with the things I should have said. Yeah, yeah. I can't breathe, so hard to breathe. 'Cause you're the one to set me free. Yeah. I don't know, I just don't know. So hard to speak and let it show. Yeah, yeah. A thousand words inside my head. And many things I couldn't say. It's because I
Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
A species of spider spreading across Britain almost claimed the life of a woman who was bitten as she lay in bed. Lynn Mitchell, age 52, spent 26 hours in intensive care after being bitten by a false widow spider at her home in Egremont, West Cumbria. And she joins me on the line now. Good afternoon, Lynn.
Good afternoon.
When did this happen?
On the 3rd of January.
And what exactly did happen, Lynn?
Well, I went to bed as normal and I woke up in severe pain. And as I got out of the bed, I pulled the covers back and there was a spider in the bed with me. And
just describe that spider, Lynn. How big was it?
Very, very tiny, about the size of your little fingernail.
Right.
And
what colour was it?
Black and shiny.
Right.
And it's just so tiny, and I just pulled the sheets back and it just ran and I just didn't think anything. And then I saw these two little marks on my chest. And what had happened is the spider experts have said that this spider doesn't normally bite, but when it's, you know, when it you know, will bite if you try to harm it.
Right.
Well, I must have fallen in a deep sleep and rolled over onto it. And, of course, it bit me.
Right.
And I got a swelling and then a blister. And the blister popped. I called the doctor.
How long was it before the blister came up? Was that almost immediately? Yeah.
Yeah. Straight away after about a couple of seconds of me seeing the spider and then looking down where the pain was. That's when the blister started to come up.
So had you ever seen a spider like this around the house before?
No, I've always picked spiders up and put them out in the garden.
Mm.
I've always done that.
But you've never seen this particular type of spider in the house before?
No, never. No.
So you've no idea where it came from?
No, by all accounts, they're well known down in the south of the country.
Right.
On the southeast coast.
But apparently they're heading north, or they have headed north.
Because of the climate changes. And the warmer weather, they've actually, started to arrive up this end. We've got two at the moment. This one was called a grosser. Grosser spider it is. That's the proper name for it. But it's actually called a false widow spider. False black widow spider it's called.
Are you lucky to be alive then, Lynn? If you hadn't woken up,
If I hadn't woken up, I'd have probably been dead in my bed. Because I woke up because of the pain. And if I hadn't woken up with the pain, then I would have probably, I would have obviously been dead, because what happened was I phoned the emergency doctor and it so happened to have been my old GP before I moved, and he came out. And if it wasn't for his quick reactions and my EpiPen, and then the ambulance coming and me being rushed to hospital and then up to intensive care, they actually had to put me on a life support machine for 26 hours.
Oh, dear. A lucky escape there, Lynch. Stay with us for the minute. I'm sure you're going to be... That sort is going to have everyone checking the beds tonight before they get under the duvet. Joining me on the line from Liverpool Museum is Paul Finnegan, the manager of the Bug House. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
Didn't realise that we had poisonous or spiders that could bite in this country.
Well, there's about 600 species of spiders found in the UK. There's only 12 species in this country that can actually break your skin. And there's none which are dangerous in this country, actually. It sounds like this has been a severe allergic reaction to the bite. We actually keep Steatoda grossa, which is the false widow, in the Bug House lab. And it's a tiny spider, and it usually has no ill effects if you are bitten.
So it's not a story that we should be getting het up about or worried
not
about?
Not really, no. I think a lot of people exaggerate things, and a lot of people love to make a big story out of nothing. And obviously this lady has suffered a severe allergic reaction. But that could be from eating a peanut or strawberries or anything. Anyone can suffer allergic reactions.
So is it not necessarily from the spider then?
No, it's probably from the spider's venom, but this is a very rare occurrence where people are allergic to it. I mean, people have been known to die from just, you know, common bee stings and wasp stings. They go into anaphylactic shock. I mean, the only dangerous spiders in the world, there's about 40,000 species found worldwide. There's only a handful out of them 40,000 species that can actually harm a human. The most dangerous spiders live in South and Central America, the wandering spiders, Fernutria ferra. Australia has a lot of dangerous spiders as well. The Sydney funnel web spider, Atrax robustus, which again is only a small spider, but that could kill you if you get bitten. And then the black widows or button spiders, people call them, Latrodectus mactans, are quite dangerous. There's lots of different kinds of widow spiders found throughout the world, and the redback spiders from Australia are the most dangerous out of all the black widows, Latrodectus hasseltii. And some people die from the bite.
Do we ever see any of those over in this country?
Occasionally black widows turn up. Yeah, we've had quite a few brought in to Liverpool Museum, mainly through fruit and veg turning up in supermarkets.
What should people do if they come across a spider that they don't recognise?
If they're not sure with it, they can always pop it in a container or pop a glass over it and slide a piece of paper underneath to trap it. And then you can always give us a call at Liverpool Museum, the bug house or the entomology department, and we'll be happy to identify any spiders which are found in this country.
So really, the advice is don't actually, you know, pick one up.
It's best not to touch spiders. No, the only way you're going to get bitten by a spider is by picking one up or by touching one. There isn't any species of spider that goes around biting people. So if you don't pick them up or you don't touch them, there's no way you're going to get bitten by spiders.
Now, Paul, the phobia, the fear of spiders is quite common, isn't it? Why do you think that is?
It is, even my young son, Bobby, has arachnophobia, and he's been brought up in a house full of tarantulas and scorpions and all kinds of exotic animals. And, yeah, he's genuinely scared of spiders. And so it's not necessarily passed on from the parents' fear. We're not really sure. Maybe it's the way they run, the way they move across the floor, and because they've got lots of legs and they're hairy, and because they come out of a night, maybe. Most spiders are nocturnal. You know, you see them of an evening.
But generally speaking, it's all unfounded, isn't it, the most fears of connected with spiders? Because most of them aren't going to harm you at all, are they?
Well, no, they're actually beneficial. Without spiders on Earth, we wouldn't be here. There'd be no such thing as human beings. We've got to remember that flies spread diseases which can kill humans, and a lot of spiders catch flies in the webs and eat them and keep down the numbers of flies on Earth. Therefore, otherwise, humans would have probably been wiped out by diseases spread by the flies, okay. The type of flies that hang around your dustbins and so on.
Paul, thanks for that.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.